case for God's existence. If you look on AP 16, Francis Schaeffer, born in 1912, died in 1984. How many people here have read Francis Schaeffer? He has some really good stuff. His argument for God's existence was real simple, so simple that it was rather deceptive. Sometimes a simple argument, you just figure, well, it can't work. But he had a really strong, simple argument. He argued that the existence of the universe could be explained by only three possible explanations. Either everything that exists came from nothing, or everything had an impersonal start, or everything had a personal start. Okay? Now, he rejects the first by saying that from nothing, nothing comes. It's just absurd to think that everything popped into existence out of nothing. Okay? If a magician pulls a rabbit out of a hat, we know that it's the art of illusion. We know he's tricking us. He didn't really create a rabbit out of nothing. Okay? So, if the universe had a beginning, and we went over the evidence last week as to the beginning of the universe, then something else had to cause it to come into existence, because nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can cause nothing. So, since from nothing, nothing comes, the idea that everything came from nothing is just ruled out. Schaeffer spends about a paragraph on that. He just does not consider that really worth his time. And I think he would be surprised to find out that today's apologists, just 15, 20 years later, like William Lane Craig, have to devote entire books to argue against the idea that the universe could have accidentally just popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. Page 135 of William Lane Craig's book with Quentin Smith, it's Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology. On page 135, Quentin Smith, one of the world's leading atheist philosophers, comes right out and says that he believes the most reasonable explanation for how the universe got here is that it popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. So that's a really deep book, and really tough to go through. The quote is also given in Chuck Colson's book, How Now Shall We Then Live? But it just shows, even in my debate with Michael Martin, I forgot to bring his books, by the way, but in my debate with Michael Martin from Boston University, he also states pretty much the same thing, that he says that since the world's leading cosmologist don't have a problem with the universe popping into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause, we should entertain it as a possibility. And my response to him was that the philosophers are supposed to tell the scientists what is possible and impossible, because that deals with the realm of reason. It deals with logic, rather than just sitting back and waiting for the scientists to make another logical blunder and then say, well, if the world's leading scientists make this logical blunder, why shouldn't we philosophers? But whatever the case, so that we're left with the other two options, either the universe had an impersonal start or a personal start. Schaeffer argues that personal man could not come from an impersonal cause. Let me explain something about Schaeffer, too. Tom Mars, out of Notre Dame, brilliant guy, but never did understand Schaeffer. And he wrote a book on Schaeffer and critiqued him, totally missed the boat. Because Schaefer was a student of Van Til, and he thought Schaefer used the apologetic methodology of his mentor. But in actuality, he used the same terminology, but had a whole different system of defending the faith. And all you have to do is go to Van Til's writings about Schaefer. Van Til did not like Schaefer. He considered Schaefer an apostate Van Tilian, and Schaefer would be the first to admit that he was not a Van Tilian from beginning to end. But whatever the case, if you're looking for, in Francis Schaefer, a logical argument, deductive arguments where the conclusions must be true, are logically, they have to be true based upon pure reason, that's not the way Schaefer argued. Schaefer's arguments are more like two guys sitting down, sipping tea in front of a fireplace, and there's a lot of reason involved, but ultimately, in the end, there's a tugging at the strings of the heart. So, you're not going to see in Schaefer's writings a real logical, deductive argument that personal man could not come from an impersonal cause. What you're going to hear are kind of kind of the overflow of his heart, and pretty much just arguing that, look, this is what personal human beings are. Sometimes he calls them verbalizers. Obviously, he means there's more to being human than that. And then when you look at a mound of dirt or primordial soup, you just can't get from the primordial soup to a human being without that personal intervention, that personal ultimate cause. So to Schaefer, it wasn't even very convincing to argue that personal man came from an impersonal cause. And this, by the way, arguing that the universe could not come into existence from nothing, totally without a cause, would refute one type of atheism. Arguing that a personal man could not come from an impersonal cause would not only refute the other type of atheism, but also pantheism, which teaches that God is this impersonal force. So basically, Schaefer is refuting both atheism, what he refers to as secular humanism in his writings, and pantheism, whether of the New Age sort or the Hindu type. And so Schaefer concludes that therefore everything had to have a personal start, that there's no way to explain the personality of man apart from a personal cause. Okay? Very similar to C.S. Lewis arguing that there's no way to arrive at reason with a small r, human reason, without reason with a big R. No way to make sense of human thinking and of human existence apart from a rational context for the universe, which entails a rational cause for the universe. So I think Schaefer has something to add there. The two books that you can get that argument from is either his The God Who Was There, they just put it back in print, The God Who Was There, or He Is There and He Is Not Silent. It's either The God Who Was There or He Is There and He Is Not Silent. However, you can get both of those books along with Escape from Reason in the Francis Schaefer Trilogy, which is a nice hardbound book, and you can probably get it for about $13 through Christian book distributors. Go to a Christian bookstore, you can multiply that by three. But they put those three books together, and the only problem I had with Schaefer, I think he was too hard on Aquinas. I've got some problems with Aquinas, but I think there's a lot of good in Aquinas, and I think Aquinas would have been proud of the way Schaefer argued. But Schaefer got the information he got about Aquinas from his teacher Van Til. And since Schaefer left the Van Tilian school of thought, he didn't even realize automatically you're jumping into a camp that is at least an ally of Aquinas. So you either stay in the Van Tilian camp, and yeah, Aquinas is a bad guy, or you leave the Van Tilian camp, and unless you go to the Clark camp, and Aquinas is one of the good guys, though you might not agree with him on everything. So, now if you go back to the page, it says evidence for God's existence, and there's some traditional arguments for God's existence, and then the cumulative case. The traditional arguments that are mentioned there, I think the only one that's not mentioned in the cumulative case down the bottom half of that page, I think the only one that's not mentioned is the argument from religious experience. Probably the best argumentation for that I've ever seen is Norman Geisler and Winfried Cordovan, The Philosophy of Religion. They do a whole section on religious experience and stuff like that, and they talk about man's need. It's an argument from man's thirst for God. The universal thirst for God, therefore God must exist. And at first it sounds really weak. And Geisler and Cordovan admit it's weaker than most of the other arguments as far as when you critique them logically. But it actually turns out to be a strong argument when you just look at it the way we humans think. Because we humans don't usually always make our decision through logic and reason. Sometimes other factors come into play. And another way of going about this would be to say, there's never been a time in the history of mankind where more than 10% of the people on Earth rejected the belief in some type of God. Okay? But what Geisler and Cordovan key on in their philosophy of religion book is they quote atheist after atheist, Nietzsche, Sartre, Freud, Feuerbach, how each and every one of these guys expressed a need for God to exist, but then stated that, of course, they knew he didn't exist, and then they tried to deal with the problem that this need is going to go unmet. And so when you go to the atheist leaders and they admit to this need for God, and then you go to everybody else in the world and they admit to this need for God, Geisler and Cordovan argue this is more than a wishful thinking, like Feuerbach argued and Freud. They argue that when there is a universal desire for something, that's what a need is. And it's not just you wishing for something, but it's just all humans by definition need this type of thing. Walter Kaufman, great atheist philosopher, he's the one who translated most of Nietzsche's works into English. In his preface to The Portable Nietzsche, he refers to man as the God-intoxicated ape. Okay? So here's a leading atheist and says the main difference between us and the apes is that we're all caught up in the God concept and the apes aren't. Now, one of the problems I would have with that, if I were him, is the fact that since he's an atheistic evolutionist, if we're supposed to be higher than the apes, then how come we're the deluded ones and not the apes? Maybe, you know, if atheistic evolution was consistent and they agreed with Kaufman on that point, maybe the apes should be up here and mankind should be down here, and maybe hopefully someday we can evolve into apes who are no longer intoxicated with the God concept. However, if we are higher than the apes, which is what evolution teaches, then maybe there's something to this God concept. You know, this is survival of the fittest doesn't always mean the strongest. Most of the time it means that which is kind of more adaptable to its environment. And invented a fairy tale about God doesn't seem to make... even the atheists argue that the belief in God is what's holding back human progress. Well, how do we progress from the apes? Because the apes didn't have it. So, but whatever the case, you find Augustine put this in, wrote this in his Confessions, the very first page. Our hearts are restless. You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. Okay? And it's just another way of saying, talking about this universal thirst for God. And so the argument for religious experience is that all men sense a need for God. Everything that man needs, even though man, you know, if man needs water and food, okay? Now lots of men starve to death or die of thirst because they don't find food or water. But it does exist. What man needs does exist, and so they argue, and they only argue with a degree of probability, not certainty, but if all mankind seems to need God, and seems to admit to a need for God, whatever man needs, we find exists, therefore God probably exists. So you can build an argument for, and this is kind of like the Shaper argument, where on paper, it's not infallible logic, and it may not seem real strong, but the fact of the matter is, even if an atheist refutes you in a debate over that issue, that atheist is still going to leave that building, and on his way home, maybe when he gets home, maybe the next morning, at some time in the real near future, he's going to start expressing his need for God. And now he might not even call him God. Well, Karl Marx, it was the utopian society, the classless society. But whenever man reaches out for something more, something that transcends the world of everyday life, and tries to press on towards that, it's kind of what some philosophers call the total commitment. It's basically what it amounts to is secular humanists, the Humanist Manifesto, number one, they said there is nothing in man alien to the religious. So they were admitting all human beings are religious, while they were also arguing there is no God. And it just does, if all human beings are religious, maybe that ought to tell secular humanists they need to take a closer look at God. Okay, now my cumulative case for God, I've been using this in my debates for God's existence ever since my debate with Dr. Peter John. I used to argue that we could prove God's existence beyond reasonable doubt, and I believe that we can. The problem is, if you make that your thesis in a debate, all your opponent has to do is raise like 1% doubt, and he could take the debate. And I don't think that's fair. And so what I do now is I treat Christian theism as a hypothesis. I argue that Christian theism is a superior explanation to atheism when it comes to describing the aspects of human experience, important aspects of human experience. And so I just argue it's more reasonable to believe in God than to be an atheist. Now, I still try to prove God's existence in, you know, 99% certainty. At the same time, even if the guy's a better debater than me and raises 25% doubt, the case for God should still be won 75-25. And so basically what I'm saying is I just decided not to stack the deck against myself and other theists before we actually engage in the debate. This is the difference between a criminal court where you have to prove a person's guilt beyond reasonable doubt and civil court where you just have to win show the preponderance of the evidence is in your favor. So if you prove 50.1% that he poisoned your dog and should pay you back for it, and if your case only proved that you were 49.9% without guilt, he's going to win. They're going to make you pay for his dog, even though the judge say, I don't know, who knows, maybe he didn't kill the dog, but the other guy did seem to tilt the argument in against him. So, and that's the way I think it's a fair way to debate. And I think too often you can present 2 hours of solid, strong arguments for God's existence, and then all the atheist has to say is, yeah, but it's always possible that there's some flaw in your reasoning, and we just haven't seen it yet. And that's supposed to win the day for the atheist. I just don't think that's fair. And so whatever the case, I argue that theism offers a more adequate explanation than atheism does for the following aspects of reality. Now, some of these we covered, and so we don't need to spend too much time on them tonight. But a few of them, I don't think we've dealt with too much. But for the first one, the beginning of the universe, we already covered that last week, the Kalam cosmological argument, that everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. And you provide evidence for the beginning of the universe through the second law of thermodynamics, the Big Bang model. I'm kind of skeptical about the Big Bang model myself. At the same time, that is the reigning model in science today. But even if you give them the Big Bang model, you end up with the beginning of the universe. And so you could argue from the beginning of the universe that the universe needs a cause, and that eventually you have to arrive at the ultimate eternal cause of the universe. We talked about, I think it was the week before last, on the continued existence of the universe. God is the sustaining cause. This was Thomas Aquinas' argument. Actually, several of his arguments. He had one moral argument, one argument from design, and three cosmological arguments. And the thrust of those cosmological arguments was arguing for God as the cause of the continuing existence of the universe, not the beginning of the universe. We talked about the design and order in the universe. Just think about it. What is the atheist explanation for the beginning of the universe? Bertrand Russell said, well, all we should say about the origin of the universe is just there, and we should leave it at that. And so as we go down these, the atheist is going to be forced to either deny whatever it is we're talking about. Like, if an atheist wants to deny the beginning of the universe, they're free to do so. Carl Sagan still held to the oscillating model of the universe, but he openly admitted that it had very few proponents in modern science, because the evidence for the Big Bang overwhelmed any evidence, supposed evidence for the oscillating model. The oscillating model argued that as the universe expands in all directions, eventually gravity will pull it back for another Big Bang, then it will expand, gravity will pull it back for another Big Bang, and there'll be an infinite number of Big Bangs in the future, an infinite number of Big Bangs in the past, as if you can add to an infinite. So you can actually refute it, refute that, just to show the impossibility of an actual number of infinites, but you could also disprove it by showing that scientists have shown that the density of the universe is not the right amount that it needs to be for gravity to pull it back. That's number one. Number two, even if you assumed that the measurements are wrong and the density is right and gravity will pull it back, there's no known principle of physics that would then reverse the collapse into another Big Bang. And then number three, even if you assume those first two, which there's absolutely no reason whatsoever to assume them, but even if you assume those first two premises, okay, you still wouldn't have an infinite number of Big Bangs. It would be like if Randy Johnson took a Super Bowl, you know, the things they came out with in the 70s before most of the people here were even born. But if you never heard of a Super Bowl, just take my word for it, they did exist. And you could take these things and throw it off of one wall hard, and it would go all the way and bounce off the other wall and just start going back and forth. Well, you can get the world's best Super Bowl and get Randy Johnson to throw a 102-mile-an-hour fastball off a wall, and it might look like it's going to go back and forth forever and ever. But eventually, the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration, catches up with it. And so eventually, you'd see the ball just standing still in the middle of the floor. And so in other words, even if there were numerous, you know, multiple Big Bangs, eventually each one would be running out of energy, having less and less usable energy, until eventually the universe would still be worn out, the universe would still have an end, which means you go backwards in time and it had to have a beginning. So you can't escape the beginning of the universe, even with the oscillating model. That used to be the steady state model, where as the universe expands, supposedly somewhere in between galaxies or whatever, new hydrogen atoms are being created. And not only has there never been any evidence that that really was going on, but Big Bang cosmologists have shown why that would contradict other factors that we know are going on in the universe. So basically, steady state model, there's no adherence to that. And I mean, this thing was so old. I mean, remember Hoyle from Hoyle and Wickramasinghe, who said that used the design argument to say that chances of life evolving from non-life totally without intelligent intervention would be the same chance of a tornado randomly running through a junkyard and producing a Boeing 747. Well, in Hoyle's earlier days, when he was convinced of his evolution, before his studies led him to leave the evolutionary model, he actually was the leading proponent of the steady state model. But it wasn't long before he admitted that it was dead in the water. It never really had many adherents anyway. So the beginning of the universe, you know, you have the theism says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Boom, there you have an explanation, solid explanation. On the atheist side, what you have is, well, either the universe is just there, or it didn't have a beginning, which goes against all the scientific and philosophical evidence that we have. So on this whole list of 12 things, and I'll add a 13th thing to it, on this whole list, the atheist either denies this aspect of human experience, which I think is more obvious than atheism is, it either denies that aspect or it acknowledges it's there, but then says it's just there and we should just leave it that way. And so in the end, either atheism becomes an explaining away of these clear, obvious aspects of human experience, or it acknowledges them but then is a complete non-explanation because it says, well, they're just there and we should leave it at that. You know, it's like, Geisler, the way he nailed this was, he made a story, an atheist and a believer, an atheist and a theist walk into the wilderness and they find a little ball. And so the theist says, oh, a little ball. There must be a ball maker. And the atheist says, yeah, a little ball, it would have a ball maker. So they go travel further into the wilderness and they find a bigger ball. And so the theist says, oh, this must have a ball maker. And the atheist says, yeah, little balls have ball makers, bigger balls have ball makers. And then they go traveling further and they find an even bigger ball. And it's the same thing. The theist says it's got to have a ball maker, atheist agrees. Then they get to a ball the size of the earth. And the theist says, well, this has got to have a ball maker. And the atheist says, yeah, no argument here. If little tiny balls need a ball maker and bigger balls need a ball maker, then a ball the size of the earth needs a ball maker. So they travel further and they find a ball the size of the universe. And the theist says, if those little balls need a ball maker, then this big ball, the size of the universe, also needs a ball maker. And the atheist looks at it, shakes his head and says, it's just there. So, you know, why do you just stop? You know, you uncover every rock and you're looking for adequate causes for everything, not leaving any stones unturned until you get to the universe as a whole, and then you just say, hands off, it's just there. This is where philosophy stops looking for answers. And so in the end, atheism actually becomes a non-explanation, a non-worldview, rather than a worldview which tries to explain reality. Okay, we talked about the continued existence of the universe, the design and order in the universe. We talked about the amount of highly complex information in a single-celled animal last week. The possibility of human knowledge, human reason, and that goes hand-in-hand with number five, the existence of universal, eternal, unchanging truths like the laws of logic. let's say, look at the one from truths first. If you look up a little higher on the page, the point F, there, under the traditional arguments, the eternal, unchanging ideas. This was an argument from Augustine. Augustine was a Platonist, meaning he was a follower of Plato's philosophy, you know, only to the degree that he could keep it with his Christianity. You know, there's some things from Plato that he rejected. But Plato argued that not only are there a whole lot of particular things called chairs, but for us to recognize a chair as a chair, we have to recognize the perfect ideal chair, the universal idea chair that exists in all those chairs. Okay, now, first it sounds like, you know, that's kind of weird stuff. But basically, what makes us classify individual chairs as chairs? Well, because like Plato said, they all share in a thing called chairness. Okay? They share the same idea. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I know a chair when I see it. Okay? But try to define it. I mean, I don't know, the best I can come is something designed for humans to sit on.
Four legs.
But even there, well, you can see with four legs, I've seen three-legged chairs.
Yeah.
I've seen chairs with no legs.
Yeah.
Just one, you know, so, I mean, yeah, it's like, you know, defining a man. What is the mannishness of man that makes a man a man? You can't say two arms because there's sometimes a one-armed man. And so you have to get right to what is essential to being a man. And if a man is still a man a day after his funeral, then even his body isn't essential to the definition of being a man, because he could still be a man without his body. So Plato was onto something there. Now, from a Christian standpoint, I would argue it this way. Let's say you came up with an idea right now, Matt, okay? If God did not know that idea throughout, now if it's a falsehood, God would have known the falsehood throughout all eternity. He just wouldn't have believed the falsehood throughout all eternity. But if you came up with an idea right now and were the first human being to come up with that idea, because God is all-knowing, okay, an all-knowing being can't learn something new, because if he learns something new, then he's learned something he didn't already know, which would mean that he wasn't all-knowing to begin with. So an all-knowing being never learns anything because he always knew it, okay? So if God knows all things, and now you come up with an idea no other humans have ever come up with, God knew that idea throughout all eternity, okay? So Augustine understood that, yes, that Plato was right, these eternal, unchanging ideas exist. They are real and they exist. But Augustine also realized something that Plato missed, and that the existence of ideas don't make sense unless they exist in a mind. And so Augustine argued that eternal, unchanging ideas, we know that they cannot come from temporal, time-bound, changing minds, because, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, that eternal truth did not come from a human changing mind, because if a human changing mind adds 1 + 2 and comes up, or 1 + 1 and comes up with 3, the eternal truth that 1 + 1 = 2 stands in judgment on his faulty reason. So these ideas are above our minds and judge our minds as right or wrong. And so eventually you have to arrive at an eternal unchanging mind as the source of these eternal unchanging ideas. Okay? And now the thing is, Nietzsche, probably the most consistent atheist who ever lived, still wasn't very consistent, but probably the most consistent atheist who ever lived, he acknowledged that if God is dead, if there is no God, then truth and morality have died with him. So if there is no God, there's no such thing as absolute truth, okay? Most atheists, they will not openly admit it. You have to really pin them down on this, because they will mask it in different ways. But ask them, do you believe in universal, absolute, unchanging, eternal truths? Okay? They'll usually come back and say, well, I believe in objective truth. And what they're talking about is, they'll consider something objectively true if enough people believe in it. Okay? Kind of truth by majority consensus. And, but whatever the case, if an atheist acknowledges the existence of these invisible, universal, eternal, unchanging truths, then it makes you wonder, well, is there anything in the atheist worldview that would explain the existence of these invisible, unchanging, eternal things? It seems like excess baggage for an atheist universe, okay? But if the atheist denies the existence of these eternal, unchanging truths, then another dilemma manifests itself for the worldview of atheism. And that is this: if there is no absolute truth, no eternal, unchanging truth, okay, then the statement, God does not exist, cannot be absolutely true. So atheism, so if atheists deny truth, they have to deny the truth of atheism. Why did the guy even show up for the debate? But if they acknowledge the existence of universal, eternal, unchanging truth, then how do you explain that with atheism? Another problem that's created, the statement, there is no absolute truth. What's wrong with that statement?
There's no absolute truth. that statement must be true, so therefore false.
Yeah, if the statement there is no absolute truth, if that statement is true, it's an absolute truth, which then refutes the statement. So the statement cannot be true. So the statement there is no absolute truth must be false. Therefore, the statement there is absolute truth has to be true. Okay. Now, when you get back to human reason, some people will say, well, okay, maybe absolute truth exists, but there's no way for humans to know it. Well, the statement, man cannot know truth, okay, if that's true, then we know at least one truth, that man can't know truth. But then it's false because we can know truth. We can know that truth. So basically, if there's only two things we know, it's there is absolute truth and man can know it. And those two things don't really make much sense in an atheistic worldview. They don't make sense in a world without God. It makes perfect sense. In a world where God exists, God created the universe and he created man in his image as rational beings so that through our reason we could find out about the universe in which we live. Immanuel Kant, I think he was the... I think he took man's attempt to find truth totally apart from God to its climax in the history of philosophy. And what he ended up with was man could know reality as it appears to him, but not reality as it is. Okay? So you basically, you know, I perceive this table in a certain way. It appears to be hard and all. And, you know, even science now shows there's more empty space there than there is solid material. But it really appears to be solid. But whatever the case, it appears to be solid. Appears to be, I don't know, some kind of light brown color. Made out of, I don't know, I'm not a carpenter. Made out of wood, I guess, or imitation wood. And four legs, whatever. Well, let's say my mind has an idea of this table, okay? How this table perceives to me. So basically, it's like my mind takes a snapshot of this table, and now in my mind, I have this idea of the table, a snapshot of the table. Well, how do I know that snapshot is an accurate representation of the table? Simple. I just take the snapshot, the idea of my mind, and put it up against the table and compare the two. What's the problem? The problem is I really don't have the table. I'm just comparing the snapshot with another snapshot. I never get past the idea, the world as it appears to me. I never get through to that and can actually see the world as it is. Now, let me say this. I don't believe that. I believe that that problem only exists if you remove the rational God of the Bible. In fact, that's why modern science was founded by Christians. Because they believed that a rational God created the universe in a reasonable way, and that this rational God created man in his image and gave man the gift of reason so that through reason man could really have knowledge, real knowledge about the world in which he lived. And so, in other words, I don't know how God bridges that gap, but I know that he does. And in other words, God is the guarantee that we can trust our senses. Not that our senses are always right, but the basic reliability of sense perception makes sense within the Christian worldview. It does not make any sense if atheism is true. And it makes absolutely no sense if pantheism is true. If pantheism is true, the physical world is an illusion. So sense perception, you might as well throw it out the window because there's nothing there to even sense. I think God is the answer to that. The way Augustine referred to it, he quoted from Psalms, in his light we see light. Okay, so basically in God's light we see light. C.S. Lewis, I wish I could remember the exact quote, but he basically the way he said it was that I think he was talking about either Christianity or Jesus, but basically, Jesus is he used the analogy of Jesus being the sun, like, you know, the sun in the sky. Not only can we see the sun, he basically, C.S. Lewis said, I not only believe in Jesus because, like the sun, S-U-N, I could see him, but like the sun, S-U-N, through him,